You're listening to Avasant on the Record, a podcast discussing key trends and insights into government-driven markets.
With Avasant on the Record, I'm August Cole, writer-in-residence. Threats from China and North Korea are reshaping allied defense investment in the Asia-Pacific. The region's military challenges are both acute, with North Korean ballistic missile and cyber threats, but also generational, as China's progress in fifth-generation fighters, submarines, as well as artificial intelligence and robotics render the maritime and air domains increasingly contested. This all puts into question the certainty of absolute U.S. military dominance for the first time in decades. To discuss what's next, we're joined by Stephen Ganyard, president of Avasant Global Advisors, and Alex Chang, senior associate. It's great to speak with you both.
Good morning.
Morning.
Steve, starting with the near-term threat perspective, we know how the U.S. views North Korea from a military or strategic point of view, but if you were to go country by country, would you hear the same thing in Tokyo or Singapore?
You'd hear it in Tokyo, but you probably wouldn't hear it in Singapore. The countries that are most interested in North Korea are the countries that North Korea is most interested in. So those are the neighbors, South Korea, obviously Japan, just due to its alliance with the U.S. But south of that, really the only other country that you'd get any interest is probably Australia. The interesting thing in Australia is that up until about a year ago, the Liberal government did not want to talk about missile defense in any context. It was too expensive, it was too hard, they didn't see the threat. But the Hwasong-15, in many ways, back in November, changed the calculus. And now Australia, realizing that their proximity and their closeness to the U.S. as a Pacific ally makes them a bit of a target as well. So the countries that don't really care are the ones that North Korea doesn't really care about either. So China obviously being on the side of the North Koreans, but everybody else has to worry about the ballistic missile threat.
And I think with a country like Taiwan, for example, they would be worried about U.S. attention being focused entirely on North Korea and getting all the attention and oxygen kind of sucked out of the room. So I think you'll see continuing worries on that front.
China, of course, is a country that every nation in the region is trying to figure out. So when you look at their One Belt, One Road initiative and very sophisticated defense spending, what does that mean for the region in terms of strategic priorities and particular defense investments?
China's really the dynamic in the region. If you look at every country from really the Khyber Pass all the way to Honolulu, the growth of China, the economic growth of China, the belligerence that's been demonstrated in the South China Sea, the Spratlys and the Paracels, and the growth of military installations, I think everybody in some way is reacting to China either economically or militarily. So if you look at Pakistan and the realignment with the U.S. And towards China, India and the U.S., against China, everybody else has some vested interest in the One Belt, One Road and the increasing military footprint in the Asia-Pacific region.
In that context, what defense investments by U.S. allies in the Pacific will have the biggest relevance for the threat environment, say, between now and the next 10 years? Is it unmanned undersea vehicles, ballistic missile defense?
I think that the Asia-Pacific region is different in many ways from what the U.S. had faced in the past during the Cold War in Europe, where distances were smaller, where land was the dominant part of the geography. In Asia-Pacific, it's maritime, it's wide swaths of ocean, it's long, long distances, and it's also a sophisticated threat that takes up more of the region than Russia did in Europe. So I think some of the things that will have to come about will be centered around ballistic missile defense for those countries that can afford it and those who feel most threatened. But there are also going to be interesting asymmetric challenges, and there are countries that can't afford all the things that either the U.S. or Japan or Australia can afford. And those countries will look for interesting places where they can create an asymmetric advantage. Unmanned underwater vehicles is one of these, where autonomy will take over and I think rule the underseas in the ways that perhaps aircraft can't do now. So much has been spent in the past really 70 years on air defenses that we're getting to the point where you know, an S-300, an S-400, an HQ-9 can threaten wide areas of airspace, but we don't have that same anti-underwater capability development, and so I think there's lots of room for asymmetric advantage in unmanned systems underwater.
Mm-hmm. In terms of asymmetric technologies like unmanned systems, I think in terms of relevance against threat in the very near term, they can't substitute for the types of traditional force structure modernization that a lot of these countries are struggling with in terms of resource constraints. I think the best thing they can do is some of the dirty work in terms of freeing up their higher-end assets for more pressing missions. And I think the other element of defense technology that doesn't get as much attention when we talk about ballistic missile defense and these higher-end capabilities is non-kinetic technologies like electronic warfare and cybersecurity and cyber offense that in the next couple of years can actually have impact if allied nations invest seriously in the capability.
Let me pull that thread about non-kinetic capabilities, because those are difficult to acquire even for the U.S. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the defense ministries that are allied with the U.S. will be able to accomplish the basic challenge of equipping forces with cyber that's tactical, electronic warfare, and the restrictions on export from the U.S. with a lot of those capabilities could be onerous? So as the flip side of that, though, maybe there's more local development. How does that look?
I think that's an interesting point. One of the things about cyber, it's not like a tank or an airplane where you can go out on the range and you can go against other sophisticated capabilities. You can't see things blowing up. You can't see what happens in a cyber force on force in the same way that you can have with a free play, with ground forces or with air forces, even naval forces. And so I think part of the challenge of cyber tools in defense is going to be, how do you figure out what you've created is actually effective, that there isn't some sort of counter, and how do you see the second, third order effects to judge relevancy?
And I think there's actually a lot of interesting technologies and capabilities in the industrial base that can definitely play a role in terms of developing electronic warfare and cyber capabilities.
I think there's also another regional thread here that points towards indigenization. We're seeing it in South Korea. We're seeing, at least politically, attempts to do so in Taiwan, in Vietnam, certainly in Australia. So Indonesia is another place. India, almost all these countries are looking to create defense export capabilities. And so it's a sort of a balance between the threat requirement and what they need in terms of their own defense, but it's also looking at new markets in terms of export capabilities. Now, very few of those countries are going to be able to threaten the major global primes at this point, but there's significant political impetus behind indigenization efforts in many of these countries that's going to bring a lot more players and a lot more competition to the marketplace within the next 5 to 10 years.
And I think that element of indigenization creates a lot of tension with and competition for investment with things like traditional ballistic missile defense, which are extraordinarily expensive. So how do allied nations like Japan and Taiwan and Korea balance that need for capability with to support the local industrial base? I think is a really critical question that we're going to have to closely monitor in the coming years.
How is that domestic conversation on missile defense going in a country like Japan, for example, where defense investment is rising, but it also is somewhat of a zero-sum game that money in one bucket can't go in another? Is there a growing prioritization that you think will be actually fulfilled?
There certainly is in Japan, as we're seeing the purchase of Aegis Ashore, which although the government is making a lot of noise about the actual procurement of Aegis Ashore, it's not going to be until about 2022 until it's operational. So these things take a long time, but in Japan there's a domestic political impetus that says we're doing this to protect our people from the ballistic missile threat that we know. I mean, Japan's the only country that's had a ballistic missile being flown over the country. They've watched with great interest with the development of a variety of North Korean missiles that are nuclear capable. So I think in Japan, it's the key driver is an increasingly capable North Korean nuclear missile capability. And so that will also be reflected in places like Canberra, because the Australians, as I said, up until a year ago, weren't terribly interested in ballistic missile defense, and now they are. So it's usually a reaction to when people say, what are you doing for us, government, in terms of protecting us from that North Korean threat?
And by contrast, the fighter development programs that you see in Japan and South Korea look a lot more complicated, defense industrially, politically, and even operationally. What is the near-term future for those when there is so much competition for resources to spend on something that pays off now, like missile defense?
Yeah, you would think that the cost, the expense, the years of development that the F-35 might dissuade countries from an indigenous fighter program. In South Korea, we'll have a program. In Japan, we'll have a program. You had Indonesia participating, although they're falling off in their payments on the South Korean program. So every country seems to want to have their own fighter program, but whether they'll be able to fund that, whether those fighters will even be competitive by the time they reach IOC is another question. And so I think to your point, these large and indigenous kinds of 4.5, not really even fifth generation airplanes are going to suck up a lot of resources. And I think at some point, most of these countries are going to have to reevaluate what kinds of programs they do indigenously, and do these programs actually serve their requirements, their needs based on the threats at hand.
And I think in a market like Japan, you're already seeing that with the Aegis Ashore purchase and the near-term focus on ballistic missile defense competing heavily against a program like the F-3, and that creates a reaction in the domestic industrial base where they're worried about their work share on coming programs. There's an increasing share of the budgets going to foreign military sales. So you'll see, I think you'll see the domestic industrial base continuing to pressure the Japanese government to carve out work share for them on these types of programs and really push for a program like F-3 to go forward despite the other near-term challenges that they're facing.
You know, with these indigenous fighter programs, though, is there a risk that focus on work share, on supporting indigenous companies, misses this big sea change in survivability, you know, because it's such a hyper-lethal environment,
right?
And that the aircraft that are produced from any nation are going to be facing such a steep cliff in the next decade.
Yeah, I think there's also an element of why you're having indigenous aircraft, and part of that is defense industrial base, but it's also politicians playing to a constituency that includes manufacturing jobs, maybe less skilled or maybe more blue-collar jobs rather than the high-end, high-tech jobs. So I think that everything we see in an indigenous, whether it's the Korean next-generation fighter, whether it's in Japan, the C-2 or the P-1, which are not globally competitive airplanes, but they're all Japanese. You're seeing a defense industrial maintenance effort that's really driven by domestic politics and not driven by requirements. Where, for instance, in Japan, you're going to buy F-35s at $165 million apiece. So if you bought them off the line in Fort Worth, you'd be getting 2-for-1. In Australia, the submarine program, the government won't even reveal how much it's costing to bring the actual construction to Australia. So these huge expenditures that are intended to maintain defense industrial base and to have jobs that politicians can point to in many ways drive indigenous programs, but they don't address the real threat requirements of a particular nation.
It makes me think, though, to be operationally relevant, why not just skip a generation in fighters straight to unmanned aircraft that actually might allow a competitive edge, because you don't see similar platforms coming out of Europe or the U.S. yet that could really differentiate, you know, from a fifth generation to a sixth generation jet.
Yeah, I think part of that is that in the air-to-air arena, which these fighters are supposed to be good at, we still haven't seen the technology advance to the point where the definitive statement can be made that the man needs to come out of the cockpit. So I think the technology still needs to advance in air-to-air. I mean, there's no reason that it can't be. I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, machine learning and AI that would be particularly appropriate to air-to-air combat. You go way back to the HIMAT demonstrator years ago that can do 6-8 G eyeball-out kinds of maneuvers where it's something that a human body couldn't do, but you throw some machine learning and AI in on top of that and swarming algorithms, and now you have an air defense capability that probably is the wave of the future. But to get to there, people are still hesitant to take the person out of the cockpit. In fact, in Japan, when we've talked to Japanese government officials, they've been adamant that the next generation fighter will have a person in it. Even when you say, look, there's not going to be an IOC for 15 years, and think about how the technology has changed just in the past 5, are you sure you want a man? Yes, we're sure we want a man in that cockpit. So it's part of this is getting the politicians past the idea of not having, you know, a person who has a recall capability in the airplane.
And I think the other element of that is access to technology. If you were to develop even just a fifth generation capability, stealth, the U.S. reluctant to export that type of technology. They didn't for Korea. They probably will not for Taiwan. So how do you get beyond the challenges of developing those types of technologies if you aren't able to convince U.S. government or advanced and Western partners to assist in the development of those types of programs?
Before we wrap up, I want to talk a little bit more about Australia, which is in the midst of a really big defense modernization. Obviously, North Korea and China are drivers of that. Are they keeping pace, though, in Australia with the threat environment, or do you see deviations from what's currently planned under some of their current modernization?
I think part of the challenge in Australia is actually defining what the threat is. So if you think about defense of Australia proper, then that's one kind of defense establishment that you have. If you would think about an expeditionary or deployable kind of capability, that's a different. So the role that Australia wants to play in the world and the role that the U.S. wants it to play is more of a power projection capability. And so the force structure would look different. So I think they're sort of hedging between the two because of the expense of power projection capability is a little more difficult to justify. So as they move towards increasing their defense budget towards that 2.0%, I think that balance in being able to convince the Australian people that they need to pay for power projection capability is going to be a real question.
Steve and Alex, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks.
To listen to more of the On the Record podcast, you can find us on iTunes or at avascent.com.